eyes. He talked from the top of his mouth, unlike the Gallon who talked from the back. I could tell you, but I'd rather not give you any dangerous ideas. I probably ought to stop enjoying this, but I couldn't remember the last time I'd had something to laugh about in this damn rebellion. Definitely not since we'd fled the Dev's Valley. And how about the fight at Ilyaz? Is it true what they say, that the blue-eyed bandit was outgunned and outnumbered and surrounded by enemies on all sides? He didn't miss a beat, his chest swelling as he drew me towards him. Oh, well, you know, what others call outnumbered, I call a challenge. I heard the blue-eyed bandit got shot in the hip. I'd let him pull me close enough that we were almost chest to chest now. Can I see the scar? My lady is very forward. He grinned widely at me. Where I come from, you have to know a girl more than a few minutes before she'll try to get your clothes off. He tilted his head forward, winking at me. Well, how about I take my clothes off, then? Before I could think better of it, I stepped back and tugged up the side of my shirt. The huge, ugly scar was hard to miss, even in the dark. Because I heard the scar looked something like this. I was pretty sure nothing he'd ever brought into the harem for Shira was as priceless as the look on his face just then. It was almost worth the risk of giving him my identity. It might not have been a smart thing to do, now I thought about it, but it sure was satisfying. He dropped my hand as I let my shirt fall back, pulling away from him. And see, I was in Fahali, and I don't remember you being there. He scratched the back of his head sheepishly as I went on. I remember fighting the Gallon soldiers in the sand, and I remember men burning alive on both sides, but I don't remember you. The act was gone now. He was watching me with real interest. But I gather you're the reason everyone thinks I can be in two different places at once, and why I keep hearing rumors about the blue-eyed bandit seducing so many women. That part made sense now. He was handsome as anything, even when he looked ridiculous at the same time, and he knew it too. What can I say? I walk into their homes to take their jewels, and they give me their hearts. He winked at Shira, who smiled enigmatically into the flower he'd given her. No, Shira was too clever to give anything away to a man she couldn't truly have. She'd taken from him. She'd used him for her child, and she was still using him. So this is your way to the outside world? I asked my cousin. Shira was twirling the flower he'd given her between her fingers, looking pleased with herself. Sam was sneaking in and wooing one of the Sultan's more gullible daughters, Miasa. I noticed she kept disappearing and coming back with her hair and clothes all mussed. It didn't take long to catch her. Very silly of her to start running around with other men when she was already engaged to be married to the Emir of Bashib. I promised not to turn them both into her father if Sam helped me.
It all worked out for the best.
The foreigner Sam shrugged again, as if to say it wasn't her brains he was interested in anyway.
The Emir of Bashib leaves his wife alone a great deal. It's not hard for the blue-eyed bandit to visit her still now and again. There he went, using my name again. My temper flared.
Believe me when I tell you, I know the blue-eyed bandit, and you're not me. So who are you, really?
Well,
he leaned his shoulder back against the wall.
You can't blame a fellow for cashing in on a very good story. Nobody told me the real blue-eyed bandit was so much more
He looked me up and down, eyes seeming to linger on the places I'd fleshed out recently. Half a year of decent meals with the Rebellion meant I wouldn't be able to pass for a boy anymore. I raised an eyebrow at him in a challenge. He coughed. So much more. And I am a bandit. Well, more of a thief, I suppose. When all these stories started spreading, it was only sensible that I'd take advantage of my God-given looks. He winked one of those mocking blue eyes at me. You wouldn't believe how much easier it is to strike a good deal when you're practically a living legend. They say you're very good, though you're obviously not that good if you wound up locked in here. I wished I could punch him. How did you get in here? I asked instead. I'm Albish. He said it like it explained everything. When he was met with my blank expression, he continued. Our country is crawling with magic. My mother is a quarter fae and my father half. Fae. That was the northern word for their gene. Only they were creatures of water and soft earth. If it's stone, I can walk through it. See? He'd allowed himself to sink back while he was talking to me, and was now elbow deep in the stone wall of the palace. It was as impressive as anything I could do. I'd give him that. What's an Albish thief doing in Isman? My talents were wasted in Albus. He righted himself, and the stone shifted just a little bit back into place. Thought I'd bring them to your desert, where people wouldn't expect a man of my talents to come after their jewels. The habit of locking valuables in an iron box doesn't seem to have made it here yet. He wasn't lying. I could tell that much. But he was hiding something I couldn't quite put my finger on. There were easier places to go than Isman if it was just money he was after. Countries that weren't in the middle of a war, for one. But he was what I'd been waiting for. Someone who could get in and out of the palace at will. And I'd been raised in Dustwalk, where we didn't look gift horses in the mouth. I grabbed my cousin's arm and pulled her away from the wall, out of earshot of Sam, the blue-eyed bandit imposter. She shook me off with a roll of her eyes that needled at me. But this wasn't the time to get annoyed at her. Can I trust him? Truthfully, Shira. Can I trust him with something important? A whole lot of lives? I've had him send letters for me to Dustwalk, she said after a moment. To my family. I wondered if I was imagining the hardness in the way she said my. Even now, she couldn't help but remind me that though we shared blood and had lived under the same roof, I'd never truly be part of her family. Well, letters and some money. I'd barely given any thought to Dustwalk in months, except to thank God that I was out of there. But I cast my mind back now. Dustwalk without a factory, with nothing, destroyed. It would be a miracle if the whole town hadn't decamped or starved to death by now. Shira trusted this man with her family. I could trust him with mine. I turned back to Sam, who was incompetently trying to tie his Shima back up. Could you carry a message out for me? Of course. I winced as he tucked the edge of his Shima in all wrong. It was painful to watch. A toddler could do better than that. How much? How much what? How much will you pay me to carry this message? He repeated it carefully, like it might be his Miragene that was at fault. I glanced at Shira, who splayed empty hands at me pointedly. The Soul Team thinks I'm too modest to wear any of the jewelry he gives me. Now that I thought about it, I realized she was surprisingly unadorned for the harem. Ayat wore gold bangles from wrist to elbow some days. She clacked with metal with every gesture. Truth is, I just put them to very good use. Everything that happens within the walls of the harem is a trade. The sooner you figure that out, the more likely you are to survive. I don't have any jewels, I said to Sam. You've already taken my reputation. Isn't that enough? Well, you weren't making very good use of it. I think I've done you a favor. Besides, stories belong to the people, he said. And considering you are very much trapped, it's going to take more than that. I ran my tongue across my teeth, thinking. I could probably get something to trade with if I had a few days. Some of the girls in the harem weren't all that careful. It wouldn't be that hard to take a bangle off them when they slept. But I wasn't sure I had that much time to waste, and there might be another way. The message I need you to carry is for Shahzad al-Hamad, General Hamad's daughter.
I know who General Hamad is, Sam said.
And for a moment, the cocky, smiling man was gone. Then you ought to know he's got money. A lot of it. And so does his daughter. I paused, then added, his breathtakingly gorgeous daughter. Shahzad would have my head if she could hear me describe her like this to some foreign thief. I wasn't even sure she was in Isman, but she was still my best shot.
I like her already, Sam said.
But there was a note of sarcasm under there. He rubbed a spot on the base of one of the fingers of his left hand. It was a distracted gesture, far away. I got the feeling he didn't even wholly know what he was doing.
Why should she believe me, the general's rich, spoiled daughter?
Shahzad would definitely have Sam's head for calling her spoiled. Here was hoping he had the good sense not to do it to her face. Just tell her the blue-eyed bandit is in the palace. I didn't dare give him anything else to pass on to her. Not about the Sultan having a genie or anything else. Not yet, anyway. I'd risked enough by giving him my identity. The real one. And that she needs someone to watch her back. Chapter 20. The Nameless Boy. In a kingdom across the sea, a farmer and his wife lived in a hovel with their 6 children. They were so poor they had nothing to give their children but love. And quickly they learned that love was not enough to keep their children fed or warm. 3 of their children died in their first winter, too weak to survive the cold. So when their 7th child was born, a son, on the darkest, coldest day of the bleak winter, they did not give him a name, so prepared were they for him to die. But their nameless son survived that darkest day, and the one that followed. He lived through his first winter and into the spring, and he lived through his 2nd winter. And in his 2nd spring, he finally earned a name. The once nameless boy was quick and clever and had a talent for going places he was not meant to be, so long as the walls were made of stone. And he saw that his family was poor while others were rich, and he did not think this was fair. So when his mother became sick in the boy's 7th winter, he took food from kitchens with more shelves than his to feed her, and he took silver from other houses to buy her medicine. That was how he walked into the castle on the hill that belonged to the lord of that county, and into the life of the lord's young daughter. The lord's young daughter was lonely in the great castle, but she was rich too, and she had learned she could have anything by asking for it. So when she asked for the boy's friendship, he gave it to her gladly. He taught her games, and she taught him to read. She learned she was gifted at skipping stones across a pond on a bright summer day, and he learned he was gifted at languages spoken in distant corners of the world. As they grew older, he became healthy and strong and handsome, so handsome that the Lord's daughter noticed. She was still rich, and there had never been anything in the world that she could not get simply by asking. So when she asked for the boy's heart, he gave that to her gladly, too. The two met secretly in all the hidden places they had found together as children. The once nameless boy's brothers warned him against the Lord's daughter. They had all married poor girls who lived in the shadow of the great castle, and though they were poor, they were all happy enough. But the once nameless boy had read too many stories of worthy farmers' sons who married princesses and highwaymen who stole rich ladies' hearts to heed his brother's warnings. He believed that he had stolen the girl's heart as well as gifted her his. So the boy was greatly surprised when it was announced to the whole county that the Lord's daughter was to be married to the second son of the Lord from a neighboring county. The once nameless boy left word for the Lord's daughter, asking her to meet him in their secret place by the water. He waited there all night, but she did not come. He waited the next night, and still she did not come. And the next night after that, too. Finally, the night before the Lord's daughter was to be wed, the once nameless boy walked through the walls of the castle, and there he found the Lord's daughter, pale hair spread across a white silk pillow, beautiful and fair in the moonlight. He knelt by her bed and woke her from her slumber and asked her to come away with him, to run away and marry him. He was on his knees, but he did not beg because he never thought he would need to. He never imagined she would refuse him. But the Lord's daughter did not take his hand. Instead, she laughed at him and called her guards, handing him back his heart on the way out of the castle. And so he learned then that girls with titles did not marry once nameless boys. The boy became determined to no longer be nameless. So he signed his life to his queen and donned a uniform, pledging to earn his name by fighting for his sovereign and his land. He traveled to a kingdom across the sea, the land without winter. There, instead of a name for himself, he found blood and guns and sand. He knew that nobody lost their names as quickly as the dead, so he fled once more. He hid himself in the sprawling city of Isman, a kaleidoscope of sights and sounds like he'd never known. When he first grew hungry, he remembered what he had once been good at, going places he didn't belong. He stole a loaf of bread his first night in the city, which he ate sitting atop a prayer house, looking out over the rooftops. On the second night, he stole a fistful of foreign coins that he traded for a bed. On his third night, he took a necklace which could have easily fed all his parents' children for a year. As he learned to slip in and out with ease among the streets, he heard a name being whispered, one that didn't truly seem to belong to anyone. A legend. So he took it for himself. He used the name to take other things, rich people's jewels and careless men's wives. He even stole a princess's heart, like the thieves in the stories he knew. But this time, he was not foolish enough to give his in return. He had learned not to give things away to anyone who asked. And so he had a name. And it fit him so well that he almost started to believe it was truly his. Until he met the girl who it belonged to. The girl in the harem with eyes that could light the world on fire. She was asking for his help. He was to carry a message to a general's daughter. He found her home easily. It was a large house with a red door in the wealthiest part of the city. He waited on a corner, watching the door, servants coming and going, watching people wearing a small fortune's worth of jewels on their hands wave at each other as he waited for the girl. Finally, he saw the general's daughter. He knew her before she even placed her hand on the red door. She was beautiful enough that it was as difficult to look at her as it was to stare at the sun. She was like something crafted her whole life with a purpose only to be seen and coveted, and she moved with the easy certainty of someone who knew that her place in the world was above most. As soon as he saw her, he recognized her, though they had never met. Her hair and skin and eyes were dark, where the Lord's daughter had been as pale as milk. Her clothes were colors stolen from the Jean, where the Lord's daughter had been the colors of the rainy skies and the rivers and the fresh grass. But they were the same. She was the kind of girl who thought she deserved everything just by asking for it. And he knew that if he knocked on the red door, he would be turned away with a scoff and a wave, because nameless bandits were not invited in to talk to generals' daughters. So he waited for nightfall in the city. Windows in the street lit up one by one and then went dark as silence drew down across the city. Except for the window that belonged to the general's daughter. He watched that window into the dark hours of the night until finally that light went out too. And the once nameless boy did what he did best and walked into somewhere he wasn't supposed to go, straight through the wall and up the stairs to where she slept. She was sprawled across colorful pillows, dark hair covering her face. He knelt down next to her bed to wake her from her slumber, but before he could say a word, he found a knife to his throat. It had happened so quickly, he hadn't seen the general's daughter move. "Who are you?" she asked. She didn't look afraid. He saw then that he'd been entirely wrong. She was not like the Lord's daughter at all. She had not been crafted to be seen and coveted. She had crafted herself to fool the world. And the easy certainty of her step was the knowledge that she was being underestimated. And she got what she asked for because she asked for it from the right end of a blade. "Answer me quickly and correctly, or you'll never speak another lie again." She pressed the blade towards his throat. And suddenly, the once nameless boy knew he didn't want a stolen name tarnished with use. What he wanted desperately was a name good enough to give to this girl. But until he had that, he would have to use another. "I've come in the name of the Blue-Eyed Bandit." Chapter 21. I knew something was different when I was woken up by three servants instead of by the sun. I was being propped up to a sitting position, and my kurta pulled over my head before I was even fully awake. "What's happening?" I made a grab for the hem, but something new was being draped around me already. "The Soul Team has ordered that you will attend him in court today." The servant who answered was the same one who'd brought me into the harem. I'd never gotten her name out of her. And here I thought I was off limits. But I suppose that was only to being treated as a wife, not as a thing to be polished up and put on display. I yanked my arm back towards myself as a woman scraped something rough along my fingernails. She grabbed my hand back and started again, making me wince at the noise. "It's a great honor." The servant gathered my long hair up, fastening a clasp behind my neck. Not a necklace, I realized. This was meant to pass for a culotte. It was fine blue cloth stitched with black that matched my hair, except it left half of me bare. My arms, my shoulder, and half my back were exposed. I almost laughed. This would never pass for desert clothes, not in a place where the sun beat down on every bit of skin it could find. This was the luxury of a city, and the decadence of a harem. She pulled me to my feet so that the clothes fell over my loose shalwar. At least I seemed to be allowed to keep that on. I could make this real difficult for them if I wanted to. I could resist and make the Sultan dictate my every movement. But the last thing I wanted was more orders. And I got the feeling that, as hard as I could make things for them, the Sultan could probably make them a whole lot harder for me. Besides, I was being permitted to leave the harem, even if it wasn't out of the palace. It had been 7 days since I'd sent Sam to Shahzad. 7 days of the same lazy indifference that marked every day in the harem. It wasn't like waking up in the rebel camp. The tension in my bones wasn't matched by anyone else's. The restlessness of an impending battle, the fear of not knowing, they were mine alone. I'd even gone to the weeping wall once or twice and strung up the white cloth into the huge tree, hoping the signal would bring him back. Nothing. Everything depended on a stupid boy who couldn't even tie a shima right, and there was nothing else I could do except wait for news. Wait like Sabria for Prince Aziz, helpless and blind to see who would die in battle. I felt like I might lose my mind. I'd be damn stupid to turn down a shot at getting a look outside. The parts of the palace that they led me through now weren't near so empty as those I had followed the Sultan through. Servants scurried past us, heads bowed, carrying platters heavy with colorful fruit or crisp, clean linens. A small gaggle of Sichuan men in what looked like traveling clothes sat in a garden that we passed. My neck craned their way instinctively as gin dashed across my thoughts. A man dressed finely enough to be an emir and trailing 3 identically dressed women swept down the hallway ahead of us, disappearing up a staircase. A pair of foreign-looking men in strange uniforms stepped aside as we passed. My heart jumped at the sight of them. They looked gallant. But no, their uniform was wrong. Elvish, maybe? We rounded another corner. I knew the gallon on sight. 2 soldiers flanked an unremarkable-looking man in plain clothes. Their uniforms were glaringly familiar, sending a twist of fear through me. But the soldiers weren't the most unsettling ones. There was something about the plain-clothed gallon man. His eyes cut right through me. I could feel them in my back as we continued on. 2 dozen curious faces turned my way the second the doors to the Sultan's receiving garden opened. All of them belonged to men, seated haphazardly around the garden on cushions. The Sultan's counselors. They were all soft-looking intellectual types, like Mahdi. Pale from lack of sunlight, too many hours spent inside studying the world and not enough living in it. Servants hovered around them like a swarm, wielding fans and pitchers of sweet fruit juices. There was only one man who stood apart from the circus. He was about of an age with Ahmed and Jin, and wearing a spotless white and gold army uniform. He didn't sit. Instead, he stood, straight as a statue, arms clasped behind his back, eyes straight ahead like he was awaiting orders. There was a pang of familiarity as I looked at him that I couldn't quite place. At the head of the garden, raised above his court, was the Sultan. He lifted his eyebrows a tiny bit as he saw me. So he hadn't known that his son had given me permission to leave the harem. Kadir sat at his right hand. Ayet was draped around her husband's shoulders, wearing the same kalat I was, but in a glaring red with silver threads. She was there to be shown off, and she knew it too, twisting her bare back to the court, showing off the complicated henna designs that decorated her spine. At Kadir's feet was Uzma, wearing the same garment in green across her tiny frame. I glanced around for Muna. She wasn't anywhere to be seen. Kadir pointedly rested his hand on the cushion to the opposite side of Ayet. I would have given just about anything to not have to sit there. but I didn't have that choice. An attendant busied herself arranging the long hem of my khalat around me, so I was entirely covered. Kadir dismissed her with a wave of the hand. As soon as she was gone, I stuck my bare foot out from under the hem. It wasn't much, but it was the best I could manage, as small acts of defiance went. I caught the eye of the man in military clothes as I looked up. He was watching me, hiding a smile behind his hand, pretending to scratch his eyebrow. Kadir. The Sultan spoke across me, low enough that the rest of the court couldn't hear. Do you not have enough of your own women to keep you entertained?
I would have, father.
Something silent passed between Kadir and the Sultan that I didn't understand.
But I seem to have misplaced one of them.
He must mean Muna. I remembered what Layla had said about women disappearing from the harem all the time, like her mother had.
I needed one more to complete my Mirajin set.
Kadir reached out and ran a hand lazily along one of the scars on my back. My body shuddered angrily in response. The way the Sultan smiled would have fooled the rest of the court into thinking he was having the most genial conversation with his son.
Lay that hand on her again, and you will lose it.
I felt an unexpected surge of gratitude towards the Sultan for coming to my defense. I quashed it. It was his fault I was here, unable to defend myself. The Sultan straightened.
Bring in the first petitioner.
He raised his voice, coming to stand at the gate that led into the court.
Commander Abbas al-Abbas, a servant announced, of the 11th Command.
The soldier who came in bowed low before speaking.
Your exalted honor, I have come to plead for a release from my command.
This is a serious request in a time of war.
The Sultan considered him.
It's clearly not for lack of bravery that you wish to be relieved, or else you wouldn't be here facing me.
The soldier seemed to swell with pride for a moment at being called brave.
News has come from my father's home. My brother, his heir, has been called by God to the Holy Order. My father has no other sons. If I don't return, my sister's husbands will squabble for his land. I wish to go home to take my place as his heir.
The Sultan considered him.
What do you think, Rahim?
He was talking to the young soldier, the one who'd seemed familiar. Rahim. I knew his name. Layla's brother, I realized. The only one among the army of the Sultan's sons that she truly considered her family. Sure enough, he had Layla's same clever, watchful eyes, though Layla's years in the harem meant that I could see some of the paleness of their Gamenix mother in her. Years spent outside the palace walls had made Rahim look Mirajin through and through. It looked like he even shared some of his father's stronger features with Ahmed.
I very much doubt my opinion could add anything you don't already know, exalted father.
Rahim's words were respectful, but there was something else there. I got the feeling the two were playing a game I didn't quite understand.
Modesty has never suited you, Rahim.
The Sultan went on, waving his hand.
I'm sure you have insights, having been a soldier for so long now. Share them. I think the eastern border is exposed, and that the 11th Command needs a soldier leading them who wishes to lead,
Rahim said. The Sultan didn't speak again straight away. He was waiting for something else. A silent battle of wills crossed the court.
And?
Rahim broke first.
The holy books teach us a man's first duty is to his father.
The Sultan smiled like he'd won some victory.
Commander Abbas al-Abbas, your request is granted. The soldier's shoulders sagged in relief. You will be relieved of your command. Name your replacement, and we will raise him up in your place. I forgot the next petitioner's endless name and title almost before the man was done announcing it, just like I forgot what he was asking for as soon as he started talking. One after another, the petitioners followed each other in front of the Sultan. One man wanted money, the next wanted land, the next wanted more guards in his quarter of the city. Rebels, he reported, were multiplying among the dock workers. The next wanted the blue-eyed bandit brought to justice. He'd stolen his wife's jewels and seduced his daughter, he reported. Well, if Sam was still alive to be muddying my name, I supposed that meant at least Shahzad hadn't skewered him on sight. Or he hadn't bothered to deliver my message yet. The Sultan listened patiently before asking the man what more he thought the throne could do about the blue-eyed bandit. I watched him carefully as he spread his hands in sympathy. There was already a price on the bandit's head for his collaboration with the rebel prince, he explained, but no one had been able to find him. The man might as well be a spirit in the desert, or a fiction. I resented being called a fiction. But then I'd resent being found out and tortured out of my mind like Saida a whole lot more. I was suddenly stupidly grateful to Sam, even if he did decide it wasn't worth his time getting my message to Shahzad. My foot was falling asleep, and I had to shift positions restlessly over and over to keep it from going dead altogether, as one boring request followed the other. I finally gave up all pretense and pulled my knees up to my chin, wrapping my arms around them to keep myself steady. I was half asleep by the time the man in chains appeared. Everybody who'd been wilting in the afternoon sun came alive again. Aziz al-Asif. The man in fine clothes who was leading the chained man took a bow as the servant announced him. And his brother, Lord Huda al-Asif. Your exalted highness. Aziz al-Asif stooped low. It is my deepest regret that I have come to ask that you condemn my brother to death. He has been conspiring to the rebellion. Is that so? There was an amused edge to the Sultan's voice. Because that is not what my spies have reported to me. What they have reported to me is that you are power-hungry, and that you are the one conspiring to ally with my son's rebellion. Which can only lead me to believe that you are lying to me in order for your brother to be executed. When he is gone, you can take sole ownership of the seat of your father's lands. A rustle went around the garden. Release Lord Huda. The Sultan gestured towards the two guards by the door. And take young Aziz prisoner. Your Majesty, Aziz exclaimed loudly. I have committed no crime. You have. The Sultan cut across him, and there was no mistaking the authority in his voice. Attempting to kill your brother is a crime. Lying to your sultan is a crime. Thinking that you can leverage my son's rebellion to your own uses is not a crime. But it is not something I will tolerate. Your execution will be at sunset, unless your brother sees fit to save you. The Sultan looked at Lord Huda, who was rubbing his wrists. He didn't object. Spread the word in the city, then. The Sultan said. I want the men and women of Isman to see what it costs to try to betray their ruler. Suddenly, I was standing back with Ahmed in his tent as he couldn't make up his mind about Mahdi, as he refused to order an execution, as he failed to give a straight order. All I'd wanted was for him to make a goddamn decision, to be a ruler, a good one, a great one, a strong one. The Sultan hadn't even hesitated. Aziz's protests were still fading as the next person was called. The day was heavy, and as the sun shifted, it turned its full glare onto us. I could feel sweat beating on my neck, running below my clothes. I could feel my eyes drifting shut as the midday heat started to prey on me. The only person who didn't show he felt it was the Sultan. Announcing Shahzad al-Hamad. I came awake as fast as if I'd been shot in the back. For a second, I thought I'd dreamed it, that I'd really dozed off and imagined Shahzad come to rescue me. But there, standing at the entrance to the garden, wearing a khalat the color of a breaking dawn, and that faint smile that meant she knew she was outsmarting someone, was Shahzad. Chapter 22. Shahzad was here. Some of the fear that had been crouched in my chest since I'd woken up on a ship escaped. I could kiss Sam's idiot face for getting my message to her.
Well, the Sultan said, this is an unexpected honor.
The honor is all mine, Your Exalted Highness. Her voice was so achingly familiar here in this strange place. It was the voice of 100 knights in the camp and under desert skies, of conspiracy and treason and rebellion. I have returned from my pilgrimage. She dropped to her knees. I come to pay tribute to my most exalted Sultan and Sultim. She dropped into a low bow from her knees until her nose almost touched the ground. She was damn good at that. I suppose she had had 16 years of practice before the rebellion. The Sultan considered her.
I thought perhaps you had come to inquire after the return of your father from the war front.
If he meant to throw her off balance with a mention of General Hamad, he'd picked the wrong girl. Shahzad started to answer, but I never heard what she said. A screech like a knife across iron split the sky, cutting her off. The entire courtyard stilled, but something inside me woke up. I knew that sound.
That's a rock.
Prince Rahim said out loud what I was thinking. His eyes were on the sky and he was on his feet.
And nearby, too.
In the city?
Kadir scoffed, but he wasn't leaning back so idly anymore.
That's ridiculous.
Of course, brother.
Rahim held himself like a soldier, his hand resting, out of some old habit, on a weapon that wasn't there.
What would I possibly know? I've only been stationed in the mountains of Ilyaz for half a decade. I only heard rocks screaming every night while you were still sleeping in the harem by your mother. But you know better, I'm sure.
Kadir took a step towards Rahim. Rahim held his ground. Kadir was broader than his brother by a good bit, but as Rahim flexed his fists, I saw the scar across his hand. It reminded me of the scars on Jin's knuckles. Kadir's hands were smooth. Rahim's hands showed the signs of a fight. The scream of the rock came again, closer this time, pulling them apart. The gathered crowd, frozen a moment earlier, turned into chaos. Men started to run for cover, and the Sultan shouted orders to his soldiers, sending them towards the walls, unslinging guns as they went. I didn't move. I just stayed, craning my head backwards, because I knew that scream. And then the shadow passed, low enough to be seen clearly, but high enough that it was out of the range of guns. As it soared overhead, two huge blue wings obscured the sun, plunging the courtyard into shadow. That wasn't a rock. It was Iz. A bolt of excitement shot through me, taking me to my feet. Iz was here, in the city. Something was trailing out behind Iz, scattering in his wake. For a second, I thought they were white cloths. But as they flittered down in the wind, I saw they were paper, a rain of paper from the sky. I reached up as soon as the first sheet came close enough and snatched it before it hit the ground. Ahmed's son was printed at the top. I traced the lines of it the way I'd traced the ink on Jin's chest so many times. Printed below it, in sloppy black ink, it said, "A new dawn, a new desert. We call for Sultan Oman al-Hasim bin Isman of Miraji to step down from his throne and stand trial for treason. Sultan Oman is accused of these crimes against Miraji and its people. Subjecting his country to unfit foreign rule in the form of the Galan army. Untried execution of parties accused of violating Galan law. Persecution of his own people without just cause. Persecution of Mirajin citizens for unproven genie magic in their bloodline. Oppression of working citizens through unfair wages. Enslavement of women across Miraji." The list went on. "We demand the traitorous Sultan Oman be separated from his throne for his crimes, and that his rightful heir, Prince Ahmed al-Oman bin Isman, true victor of the Sultan trials, be allowed to ascend in his place and return this desert to its rightful glory. If he does not comply and surrender the throne, we will seize it on behalf of the people of Miraji. A new dawn, a new desert." The rebellion had come to Isman. I read it over again. I was so absorbed I didn't notice anyone near me until I felt the hand on the back of my neck. I started to spin, but Uzma had already darted up behind me, quiet as a shadow, unclasping the kalat where it fastened at the nape of my neck. The fabric came undone, slithering off me towards the ground. I grabbed at it, letting Ahmed's son slip to the ground, but too late to keep my body totally hidden. Uzma's nasty little eyes took in my body, judging it, finding it wanting in every possible way with one glance. "Now that is a nasty scar. Did the tailor Abdul not stitch you together right?" She meant the one on my right hip, where the bullet had gone through in Ilyaz. My fingers were still fumbling with the clasp at my neck to tie the kalat back up. I could feel my skin burning under her mocking gaze. "It all makes sense now. Let me guess. You're a whore who got pregnant, and they had to try to cut the thing out of you." I gave up on the clasp without the servants to help me and reached up to knot the loose ends of fabric together. Uzma took a smirking step toward me as I struggled. One of the pamphlets crumpled under her bare foot, Ahmed's son wrinkling. "How about you step away from her?" The voice was iron and silk and wholly familiar. "Before I knock you back." Shazad wasn't armed, but she looked as dangerous as she would have been with both her blades drawn as she stepped between me and Uzma. I tugged the knot tighter at the base of my neck. When I looked up, the smirk on Uzma's face flickered. Shazad leaned forward, forcing Uzma to stagger backwards. "My apologies," Shazad said in a tone that didn't sound sorry at all. "That may have sounded like a suggestion. It wasn't. Go." Uzma took two steps back, heading straight for Ayet, who was watching from the shadow of one of the pillars. Then Iz screamed again, and both of them disappeared, fleeing for cover. leaving me facing my best friend amid the chaos of the rapidly emptying courtyard.
I told you about watching your back, Shahzad said.
I told you I knew I could count on you to do it for me. I longed to embrace her, but there were too many people around still. I could explain it away if we were caught talking, but embracing might be harder. I had to be satisfied with plucking at the ornate sleeves of her khalat.
I reckon you're the only person I know who can look that intimidating while wearing something with quite so many flowers on it.
Shahzad flashed me a messy smile. All the better to be underestimated in. Come on.
Shahzad grabbed my hand, glancing around quickly. We're getting out of here, now.
She started pulling me towards the gates. Nobody was looking at us as Iz screamed, passing over the palace again. The Sultan had vanished, and everyone else was running for cover. It was a good chance to get out.
This is supposed to be a distraction?
I gestured at the pamphlets littering the ground underfoot.
Things can be a distraction and serve the cause at the same time.
Shahzad was still pulling me towards the gate.
Can you walk any faster than this?
My mind caught up too slow. I pulled Shahzad to a stop. It wouldn't matter if I could outrun a Buraki. I'm trapped. I filled her in as quickly as I could, as chaos reigned around us still. The iron under my skin, and one piece of bronze allowing the Sultan to control me.
Shahzad's face darkened as she listened.
She took it in with the same sharpened focus she always had when things were serious.
So we cut it out of you.
I know I'm not as clever as you, but that did cross my mind. I deadpanned to her.
It could be anywhere, and I'm as likely to bleed out as anything if you start sticking knives into me.
I'm not leaving you here, Shahzad argued.
You don't have a choice right now, I said.
Shahzad!
I was long on things I wanted to say to her and short on time. Soon enough, the chaos Iz had created was going to die down and someone was going to notice us. There was only one thing that mattered, one last piece I hadn't told her.
The Sultan has a genie.
Shahzad opened her mouth, then closed it.
Say that again?
There wasn't a whole lot Shahzad couldn't do. She could command armies. She could form strategies that she could see play out 8 steps ahead of anyone else. She could fight and maybe even win a war that we were outnumbered and outgunned in. But there was outgunned, and then there was fighting a gun with a stick. If the Sultan had even one genie, that wasn't anything an army of mortals could stand against.
So, we need to get both you and this genie.
Bahadur, I filled in, even though I wasn't sure why it mattered. It was just another genie. He was a genie who had fathered me and whose name was half of mine. But he wasn't my father.
Iz screamed and dove low. Guns went off. We both ducked on instinct.
Both you and Bahadur, out of the palace.
She made it sound simple.
Freeing a genie isn't like breaking Saida out of prison.
Not that that had exactly ended well anyway.
He's trapped here, just like I am.
I'll get some people to look into it.
Shahzad pushed her hair impatiently off her face. Somehow, even dressed up to look as harmless as a flower, there was no mistaking what she was capable of.
God knows half of the rebellion isn't doing anything useful right now. Isman is its own kind of prison, and it's swarming with soldiers since the ceasefire.
Ceasefire?
I interrupted.
Shahzad looked at me, startled,
like for a moment she'd forgotten I'd been absent. Her mouth pressed into a grim line as she broke the news. The Sultan has called for a ceasefire, an end to the fighting with the invaders, until their foreign rulers can come to Isman to negotiate a new alliance. That's the news Jin was bringing us back from the Sichian camp before... She hesitated. Everything. The mention of Jin made my heart clench. Something about the way she said his name was off. But I had more pride in myself than to ask about him when we were at war. That's why the palace is swarming with foreigners, I said instead, thinking of the crowd of uniforms and strange men we'd passed on our way here. You think the foreign rulers will come? Rumor has it, one of the princes of Sicha has already set sail, and the Galan Emperor and Albish Queen have both sent their ambassadors ahead of them. I thought of the plain-clothed man whose eyes had chilled me. They'll come. If they don't, there's too great a chance the Sultan will make an alliance with one of their enemies. Meanwhile, soldiers from all sorts of places are flooding into the city from every border to pave the way. Shahzad tapped her fingers to her thumb, one after the other in quick sequence. It was a nervous gesture. It meant there was more. Problems she wasn't telling me. Complications with the rebellion that I wasn't privy to. What does that mean for us? I recognized this feeling of being helpless when there was so much to be done. I used to feel like this in Dustwalk. Nothing good. She caught the nervous tick and stopped, balling her hand into a fist. Especially now. But the Sultan can only ally with one country. As soon as an alliance is struck, war will spark again. The rumors say he's planning to announce his new ally at Aurangzeb. But until then... She trailed off. I knew what she meant. Until then, we had trouble. And it could only get worse with the Sultan having an immortal being at his command. My mind turned over. There might be another way to figure out how to free a genie. I just have to get out of the harem long enough to find out. But something kept me from mentioning that to Shahzad. We were running out of time. Iz's distraction could work only so long, and we couldn't be caught conspiring. But I couldn't let her leave without asking. Shahzad, is everyone all right? I didn't ask what I wanted to ask. It was stupid and selfish, but his name hammered against my teeth. Is Jin all right? Not everyone. For not being a Demji, Shahzad had always been the honest sort. Mahdi died in the escape from the camp, and we couldn't save Saida. A few others, but the death toll is as low as can be expected. Ahmed is alive. Delilah, Hala, Emin, the twins, they're all here in the city. And Jin? I couldn't stop myself anymore. She hadn't mentioned him, which couldn't mean anything good. Neither could the hesitation that followed my question. No one is exactly sure where Jin is right now, Shahzad said finally. He... She shoved her loose hair up off the nape of her neck. After you disappeared in the dead of night, he rode a horse half to death to get to the meeting point. When you weren't there, he broke Ahmed's nose and turned back around in the desert to find you. Thank you for proving me right in my skepticism about the lack of detail in that plan, at least. I knew she was trying to lighten the mood, but worry had taken root in my chest. It had never crossed my mind that Jin wasn't with the rest of the rebels. He's still alive. I tested the words out loud, and then I realized what she'd said. He broke Ahmed's nose? Shahzad scratched her ear, looking as sheepish as I'd ever seen her. Ahmed might have implied that if Jin stopped treating you as casually as some girl he'd just met in a dockside bar, maybe you'd stop running away. A surge of indignation that Ahmed thought I'd leave the rebellion over a